that in some way it formed an alliance with body. This alliance through the mystery of birth was difficult for early man. But a separation from body at death was not so difficult for him to comprehend. He saw the body become inert. He saw disintegration set to work within it. He even recognized disintegration itself as a form of life. But he saw that this friend, this brother, this parent, this child, who had come to the mystery of death, that the body, though it remained for a time, had lost something. Something had left this body. And the thing that had left it was the living being with nature, with temperament, with disposition, with attitudes, leaving behind only a comparatively commonplace body, which had no particular attributes, nor was it particularly interesting in itself in any way. The thing that was interesting was gone. The challenge was gone. The dynamic was gone. All that remained was clay, and the processes of disintegration were gradually destroying this body. They did not destroy it while the person lived. Therefore, in order that it might be destroyed, that person must leave or go. Something must change on the inside, or this body could not disintegrate. From all these observations, and from vast centuries of meditation upon them, man devised gradually the concept of immortality. He also devised the concept of the victory of life over death. He recognized the possibility of an existence apart from body. He recognized this existence as possible by the simple phenomenon of death itself, where he realized that at death, everything that was important went. The dead man did not leave his mind behind him. He did not leave his emotions behind him. As a person, as a being, he totally departed. The only thing that he left was a body. It therefore occurred to the Egyptian and the Hindu and other ancient peoples also that which departed was a self-sufficient being, differing from the ordinary being only in one particular, namely the absence of a tangible body. This led primitive man to surround the living with beings unembodied in the air around him. He believed that these beings had departed no great distance, that they were alive, that they were there, that they could accept his sacrifice and answer his prayer. The only difficulty was he could not see them. But even in this, there was an exception. In sleep, he could see them. They could return to him as dreams. He could internally restore their appearances. And he had a kind of inner life, which seemed to bring him into contact with the kind of world where beings without bodies could live. And most of our early concepts of the afterworld were derived from dreams, from man feeling or believing that in sleep he passed through a kind of temporary death. St. Paul said, "I die daily." And that in this sleeping procedure, the being also left the body or separated from it in some way. Therefore, because man could sleep, be unconscious, not know, and not remember, yet he could awaken without any volition of his own. That sleeping and waking and all the decisions of life rested in the being, not in the body. The being could come and go as it pleased. It was the protector, guardian, master of the body. Thus all our magical cults bring in these points, as Frazier points out in his Golden Bough. In this, man then began to contemplate the broader reaches of things, and by the time of the rise of the great classical civilizations, the great philosophical systems of India, China, Egypt, Greece, Babylonia, Assyria, in these days, men had also some knowledge of anthropology. They had some knowledge of the origin of species. They had a reasonably accurate insight into the historical descent of man from a savage to a cultured state. They also had a religious conviction, such as we find in the book of Genesis, where we discover that at a certain time, in the development of primitive man, a fraternity was established between being and body, that being came to body, and that what we call humanity was actually a race of invisible beings that became embodied, that man had a psychic life that was eternal, everlasting, neither having beginning nor end, and that in this process of its eternal continuance, it formed periodic associations with body, as in the East Indian doctrine of rebirth. Rebirth being nothing more or less than the periodic re-embodiment of a being having the power of continuing between lives, even as consciousness has the power to continue in sleep or to pass through unconsciousness without dissolution. In the study then of the anthropological concepts, the Christian philosophers, borrowing considerably from the old Jewish teachers, decided that man was a unique creation, inasmuch as he was an ensouled animal. He was a being different because a superior order of life had entered into him, possessed him, and had made his body their temporary abode, or the abode of this order of life. To accomplish or to interpret this, they had to explain what would bring the soul or the being toward body. And out of this have come several different theories. The most familiar to us, of course, is the theory of the fall of man. In other words, man is embodied as the result of sin. That in some mysterious way, a divine order of beings rebelled against God. And for this, the order was hurled into the abyss, as Milton tells us in Dante in Paradise Lost. I'll get it in a moment. Milton's Paradise Lost. In this situation, we find an order of beings hurled headlong from the heavenly sphere as a result of the rebellion of the angels. In this case, the fall was due to disobedience, was therefore incidental or accidental. This, however, is not the common opinion of all peoples. Others believed that what we call the fall was a perfectly natural process in nature, representing no punishment, but the inevitable need of the being to experience all things. In other words, we can say the deity, or absolute spiritual life, scattered itself as seed throughout space, and from these seeds grew up orders of life, which are God, or our one divine nature, unfolding throughout time and eternity, to final restoration of their own total divinity. that therefore evolution, or a natural function of laws, is responsible for what we term the fall of man. This was the essential concept of the 19th century philosopher Herbert Spencer. Here we have two processes, involution and evolution. Involution being the motion of being into body. Evolution, the gradual motion of the release of being through body, and in a sense, from body. This concept, then, held as its principal situation or purpose that man, in what we term the evolutionary arc of his existence, has as his primary purpose as a being the full expression of this being in conduct, that this being is gradually molding, refining the body until this body becomes suitable to give full and complete expression to the being. That growth, as we know it, is the revelation of being through body. That what we call evolution is ideation, or the unfolding of a conscious entity through the instruments or vehicles by means of which it is able to function in a material state. Thus, for man, evolution is the unfoldment of being into ability for total function in the state of matter, and total victory over the mystery of matter, or the dark side of the unknown as this relates to matter. Most of the philosophic peoples have taken it for granted that man's embodiment was due to a divine plan, or a divine order, or a divine will. But that having attained this embodiment, man then inherits a peculiar and natural human duty. If he is in body because of a divine plan, it is part of this plan to so place man here as to challenge him to work out his own salvation with diligence. Therefore, the primary purpose of man in this world is that he shall unfold himself through his body and shall attain dominion over the negative aspects of his own personality, these negative aspects being responsible for the ignorance and materialism with which the ages have been darkened. Thus, our real reason here is that we may rescue ourselves from the state of unknowledge or partial knowledge, which is the source of the confusion, misery, and misfortune by which we seemingly are incessantly dogged in nature. If this followed their ancient idea, then the question is, how and when did these things happen? Anthropology, on a material level, definitely postulates something. It does not know exactly what it postulates. It does not even assume, perhaps, that the complete statement of its postulation is possible. But it does distinctly note that at some time, under certain or some condition, man divided from the animal. That this division was more than the mere process of standing on its hind legs. We may be reasonably certain that this elevation of posture was bound to something in nature more important than the fact that man preferred the food that grew high. Apparently the giraffe did the same, but did not become human as a result. Nor are we to assume that man inevitably proceeded from the anthropoid, or from the so-called great apes. These apes, it is true, have certain attributes and characteristics which are reminiscent of a primitive type of humanity. But the ape, although it has the body approaching that of human type, is still essentially an animal. It is a little wiser and a little more cunning than some animals, but it is not a dreamer. It has never created a work of art. It has never built a city. It has never dreamed a great religion into existence. This creature is still tied or bound to a kind of creation. Or, if we do not wish to take this ground, and there are some who would like to differ, they will say that the primary difference between the beast and man is the vocal equipment, which has made possible the transmission of knowledge. This, however, is not entirely true, for we have in the animal kingdom intuitive faculties for transmission that are much more acute than human faculties. And we find that the animal, like all other creatures in nature, is able to transmit that which is necessary for it to transmit. And that in this man has achieved no more, although he is on a different cultural platform. But actually, somewhere, anthropologically speaking, we have what Gabriel Max attempted to portray as the missing link. We have something that occurred. This something transformed man, placing within him a fire. And the Greeks symbolized this by Prometheus bringing the flame from heaven in a hollow stalk. This bringing of the flame, which centering itself in man, created in him a separateness that was to not only continue but to increase until an entirely new order of life was differentiated. This problem, when it happened, how it happened, what happened, these questions have never been satisfactorily answered by material science. The answer to them perhaps merely lies around some corner, and they hope that someday they will find it. But in the meantime, they have not found it. And we can suspect that some of our more intuitive ancestors had a better explanation than we have now. Not necessarily better than we may have sometime, but certainly better than we have today. One reason being that we have given up. The modern man is not really asking these basic questions anymore. He is intriguing his mind with secondary questions, and frustrated in his effort to solve primary matters, has turned from them. Because to continually think of them is only to remind himself of his own inabilities. Actually, the ancients did contemplate this problem and attempted to understand it. And old mythologies and ancient legends and lore, all rich in this particular phase of speculation, in this type of thinking. The early Jewish scholars who were associated with the development of the Bible were of the distinct impression that there were two creations described in Genesis. The first being the creation of man, and the second being the creation of Adam. And you will find that they are in different chapters of Genesis even now. Now, it is interesting that at the end of the first chapter of Genesis, man has been created. But the Lord is not satisfied. Because, as one of the verses tells us, there was no man to till the ground. So even after the man was created, there was nobody to till the ground. The man who was to till the ground did not come until the coming of Adam. And the two creations are distinctive. Some scholars are of the opinion that this was the result of the early blending of two totally different concepts of origin. One the Elohistic and the other the Yahvistic. That the ancient Jewish philosophy came from two roots. And that these two roots were never completely brought together. And that the two creations of man in the opening chapters of Genesis relate to this phase of the old philosophy. Actually, however, there seems to be more to it than this. We are not told in the first creation that the Lord breathed the breath of life into that man. The first man was not made a gardener or a keeper of the garden of the Lord, nor was he given the power to name all things according to their natures. This came later. It was this man, the second man, who fell, and who was forced from the garden, and who also was given the coat of skins, the body, in which he must suffer and labor, and perpetuate his kind with the sweat of his brow. The first man was the Greek anthropos, the idea man, the archetype, the man in heaven. And to these ancient peoples, the being in the body. The Adam Kadmon, the man made of the red earth, flesh, was the second man, the body. And it was into this body that the breath of life, the psyche, the soul, the ghost, meaning breath, was given or was transmitted. And it was this man who also in due time became male and female and went forth, the man to earn his bread with the sweat of his brow and the woman to bring forth her children in pain. These were the body. These were the final result of the union of being and body. The unembodied being lived in heaven, and it was believed by the ancient Jewish scholars that the first man attended the school of the angels in heaven. The second man lived first in ether, in atmosphere, the body being a condensation gradually of invisible gases and substances. Finally, he fell into a mortal or material state, becoming a physical body, precipitated out of invisible substances in the same way that a solar system is a visible structure precipitated out of space and sustained by space, space itself being totally invisible and yet the inevitable source of every visible thing that exists in creation. Thus the motion of things from an invisible condition into a visible one may be regarded as a kind of fall. But this being that fell into body, fell into a kind of sleep. And the Greeks have the same concept of souls falling into generation. Plato tells the same story. The Hindus have it, the Chinese have it, the Buddhists have it. All these accounts then lead to the inevitable concept that at an X point, which we may not be able to date in terms of chronology, but we can date it in terms of anthropological phenomena. At an X point, the primitive creature, which was to be and had been fashioned to be man, was quickened or made alive and became a living soul. This immediately set the destiny, but there was no visible phenomenal moment in which this could be identified, for it required a very long time for the gradual drift of the ensouled animal from that animal which had not received the being into itself. Berosus, in his Chaldean history, describes this problem also, speaking of the laboratory of nature in which innumerable forms were generated, forms with many heads and arms, forms with many bodies, giants and pygmies, the most incredible diversity. We ridicule it today, but there is nothing that he describes more incredible than a dinosaur or one of the pterodactyls or a brontosaurus. All these creatures we would not believe ever existed did we not find their fossil remains. No one could have convinced us otherwise. But Berosus tells us that in the dawn of things there was this riot of forms, and then that these forms gradually became orderly, and that among them the gods brought forth bodies suitable to become the habitations of beings. One way of saying the gods brought forth or created or fashioned would be simply to substitute the term evolution. Nature at some time produced an organism that could be ensouled, and in so doing automatically drew life to it. For a body can never excel the life within it. And as body grows, the life within it always appears to exceed the body in which it is functioning. This brings us to an interesting philosophical truism advanced by Pythagoras of Samos. And he does it by means of his numerical philosophy. Pythagoras points out that you can take physical substances, and that these physical substances become, in a sense, ensouled always by totalities. One way to express that is to take six matches and place them along in a row. The moment you do this, you ask someone, what is there? And they will say, six matches. Now, the term six is itself not composed of six parts. It is a single term to cover the phenomenon of six parts. Yet the concept of six is a unity, apart from the elements which produce it. Therefore, six of any single objects brought into relationship with each other immediately create a unit or a unity which we call six. The soul of six is born when six items, units or elements, are placed in relationship so that they may form that design or bring forth the symbolism of that number. Now, if you remove one of these matches, the unit six disappears, and another unit takes its place, five. Now, five is not just merely the sum of five separate pieces. Five is a total being or an entity in itself, an entity termed five. Five is a word which is the name of a sum, and that sum is a total. Yet by adding to and subtracting from the matches, all different kinds of sums are brought into manifestation, then the combination is changed and those sums are removed from manifestation. And a different one, a different sum, takes their places. Assuming man, for example, as Pythagoras says, to be equivalent to the number six. When nature brought together a series of parts constituting a sum called six, the result was the construction or the manifestation of an instrument by means of which the total concept of soul as six could come into existence. Therefore, in evolutionary procedure, the ensouling of things or their embodying is always the result of nature's abhorring a vacuum. Whenever a situation arises in nature, that situation must forever be ensouled. Any pattern that arises becomes the instrument for an entity. Any change in pattern destroys that particular availability, and that entity ceases to manifest. But nature is producing eternally combinations or patterns, and the moment they form an orderly archetype, they are ensouled by a principle. Therefore, every pattern in nature is ensouled by something which is a plus to the pattern itself, or additional to the sum of its own parts. And the thing that is greater than the sum of its own parts is the new entity or being composed of that sum. In the evolutionary procedure, the ancients firmly believed, therefore, that the time came when the motion of growth in nature produced a kind of organization in which a certain type of being was drawn from space and was able to associate itself or was invoked into union with this form. And that when this occurred in man, we have the living soul. Now that Pythagoras should have hit upon this formula is interesting, inasmuch as Buddha has told us that what we call the being is actually also the product of six factors, which are called attributes. And that the union of these six constitute the instrument for the manifestation of man. All of these points then, anthropologically speaking, simply indicate a time or a period infinitely remote in which man emerged as the compound of being and body. And that from that moment on, the whole progress of man has been the continuous flowing outward of being into and through body, and being moving through body into nature is the cause of culture. That culture is the manifestation of the being, not merely the works of the body. That culture does not arise, totally at least, from the activity of environment or heredity upon the organism. That true culture is the motion from within the organism of being through body. You might say under those conditions then, why is culture different? Why is culture gradated? Why have some peoples achieved it and others have not? And why are various cultures so essentially dissimilar in many respects? The answer to this is rather simple, however, when we think about it. Here, anthropology comes in with the correct solution. Anthropology shows us that the body, with its various instruments, is in a constant process of modification. And that these modifications of the body are the result of both heredity and environment. Therefore, heredity and environment, by their effect upon the body, determine its availability as an instrument of being. Thus, body, which is not so highly evolved in terms of organic qualifications, is not as readily available, nor can being moving through this body achieve the cultural maturity immediately that it can if it is moving through a better body. Being, for example, we have no reason to suppose is any different in a 2-year-old child than it is in a 40-year-old adult. The difference between infancy and adulthood is not in being but in body. And anthropology is the story of the racial development of man from infancy to adulthood. Consequently, it reveals to us not the essential nature of the being, but the availability of the maturity of the body in its varying degrees. The small child is comparatively helpless, not because it is deficient in being, but because it is deficient in body. At various periods in its growth, through childhood, adolescence, and early maturity, the burden of its biological, anthropological, and ethnological development is so great that it is not available at any time for the complete release of the being within it. What we call majority or maturity is actually the body attaining a degree of maturity or completeness by means of which a moderate or normal degree of manifestation is possible through the being in the body. Here, therefore, we do not actually conflict between what might be perhaps called an idealistic approach and a materialistic approach. The difference lies in the source of the motivating factor. The anthropologist sees something happen. In various departments of living, we also see things happen, but we do not always see the causes of these things. And the position here is that anthropology is the story of the gradual growing up of a kind of creature. And anthropology, therefore, is perfectly correct when it wishes to outlaw forever the idea that certain peoples are better than others, or that certain races are better than others, and to reduce all these elements to the simple fact that all things which are consistent with themselves may be regarded as good. That which keeps its rules is honorable, and honor has nothing to do with the color of skin or the ethnological development of a people. It is an attainment on a culture level by means of which things are measured in terms of themselves instead of terms of something else. On this basis, your philosophical or so-called esoteric viewpoint would also carry the same essential burden. The average parent does not regard his child as inferior, because he recognizes within that child growing processes which he himself as an adult has passed through, and he is perfectly certain that in due course of time this child will mature and will become an adult, and therefore will come into his natural heritage. The modern anthropologist is beginning to think the same way, that the different racial levels are the degrees and the unfolding of a body which is moving toward its natural maturity, and that the only superiority or inferiority must be measured in the terms of what is the essential difference between a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old child. There is only the difference of time, the difference of a little more opportunity for the maturing of the body, for the being within it. But anthropology is in no way convinced that the essential nature of being as psychic entity is determined by the appearance of body or by its cultural attainments alone. Therefore, that what we are really dealing with is an eternal motion of growth, and that it is impossible for us to accurately determine the comparative merits or demerits of the various stages of this growth. That all we must bear in mind is that the end of this growth is the victory of being over body, or the attainment of ethnological and anthropological maturity. And that what we look forward to as a golden age or a better time is little more than this. That it is simply man finally gaining the maximum degree of manifestation by means of which being is released freely and adequately through body. We have the same thing on a cultural level, where we have arts and sciences. A child born with the potential of a musician may never become one, unless he is given advantages in music. He may remain forever a musician in his soul, but his ability to express this music means that he must train the body as an instrument of purpose. And it is only when he has trained his hands properly to respond to the instincts and impulses of his mind and emotions that he can play the piano. Thus, the body must be brought within the discipline of the being, and must become the instrument for the expression of that being, or the being itself remains forever inhibited. And anthropology, the descent of man, the cultural life of man, is the gradual revelation of this, the constant evidence that man and nature are conspiring to produce the kind of body by which the being may manifest its own integrity. This again brings up a psychological factor in connection with this, namely the possibility that this being itself is subject to certain infirmities, certain sickness, certain attitudes, by means of which, for example, collectively speaking, a race can destroy itself, or a culture can destroy itself. Here we come to a very complicated situation, and that is the relative interdependence of being and body. The being instrument, as we know it, the psychic nature, has been seriously misunderstood, or certainly abused, in the terms of our modern thinking. We have come to the conclusion that being and mind represent synonymous terms, that being is superior to body because it is intellect. Nearly every one of the great thinkers of the ages have pointed out the fallacy of this position. They have warned us about it on the religious level and on the philosophical level. They have pointed out clearly that the intellect is not the being. Therefore, that the gradual substitution of intellect for being is a form of dying. That just as surely as being is forced out of manifestation by the crystallization of body, so being as culture, as the psychic entity of culture, is forced out of incarnation by the crystallization of a mental concept as a substitute for culture. In other words, when a culture crystallizes, it is the same as a body that gradually falls victim to rheumatism, arthritis, and other ailments. Gradually, the power of the being to function through the body is destroyed. If, therefore, intellect and emotion, through misunderstanding, are given a dominance or a preference, and gradually force the being into an unfavorable relationship with body, we may destroy a culture. We destroy it because we destroy its soul. This does not mean that we actually destroy the soul per se or in its own nature. Rather, we destroy the bridges by means of which the soul functions through the body. We lock the being. And the moment we lock the being, we are in a difficult situation. Being, as it is superior to body, cannot be held by body. And when a body is no longer suitable, and there is obviously no remedy possible, and a process of crystallization or disintegration has gone too far, being simply severs its relationship with body. And when soul severs its relationship with a culture, that culture dies. When the soul severs its relationship with a concept, that concept becomes extinct. Whenever the being finds itself in a condition utterly unfavorable, it departs from that condition and proceeds to move into other conditions more suitable. Now this tremendous stream of life moving along presents us with a number of opportunities or a number of specializations. Being has a choice of old cultures, rich in experience but infirm with age, of contemporary dominant cultures, mostly utterly confused, and of aboriginal cultures, as yet comparatively undeveloped and for the most part unspoiled. Therefore, you will observe that wherever we get to a point of decadence on an anthropological level, we almost immediately release a backward people. A so-called primitive people begins to move forward. The power of the world moves. In the case of the Roman Empire, The Roman Empire became culturally delinquent, became culturally corrupt, became like a body so ridden with disease that it could no longer function, or a psychic organization so ridden with complexes, fixations, and neuroses that it could no longer serve as an instrument. Immediately we find culture moving out. Those that still possessed it in the Roman Empire went into the Near East and Arabia and created a new renaissance of culture there. That part which did not have sufficient strength to survive, that which had not recognized the difference between true and false culture, then passed under the influence of the Goths, the Huns, and the Ostrogoths. They were conquered by barbarians. And out of the barbarians came a new order of culture. And just as the Romans got arrogant, so the barbarians in due term became cultural and arrogant. And step by step the process is repeated. But always, where a people or a culture group which has been dominant loses dominance, and it must always lose dominance by betraying its own psyche. It must always block the motion of being within itself. When this happens, being seems to depart, and the weight of culture passes to another people. This people suddenly becomes alive, after perhaps resting as the Huns and the Goths had rested for 1,000 years, without any more than tribal motion. Something happened. And within 500 years, these people moved into a dominant place in civilization, gradually filling the most important place of their time, the place left a vacuum by the collapse of the Roman Empire. Always, therefore, culture, instead of dying, moves toward primitive integration. The answer being, of course, that it is easier to work through a young body and build it forward than it is to work with an old and opinionated nature that already has built tremendous obstacles to progress. This is the reason why, in anthropological culture, the great motivations, the great vital pressures of culture, are usually in the hands of the young. That is why the motion of generations arises from several sources. Youth inherits the cultural tradition. That part of the cultural tradition which is solid becomes useful to it. That which is decadent, youth resents and rises against. Youth makes its tremendous contribution, and then, having exhausted its initiative, it sinks back and waits for another generation of youth to carry on. But the motion is carried by youth. The consequences are contemplated by age. Each generation has its own youth. Every person who reaches age has had his hour of youth, has made certain motions. But in culture, a people unspoiled, as yet without the locking of sophisticated opinion, in each case rises up to meet the place left by decadence. That is perhaps culturally the reason why today many of the great arts of our people are coming to recognize the importance of the so-called folk arts of primitive people, simply because modern man culturally is sinking into an ocean of dishonesty. And he is seeking in every way that he can to discover the one thing he knows he must have in culture, and that is honesty. Primitive man is honest and unschooled. Decadent man is schooled and dishonest. The struggle, therefore, is to recapture value. And the recapturing of value, if it can be done, preserves youth and perpetuates people. Those who do not grow old or lock themselves in the crystallization of their generations are the ones in whom creativity has remained, and who are able to be young in the sense of dynamic, and continue their dynamic through continual adjustment, which is the key of youth, whereas inability to adjust is the proof of age. In this, then, we have the concept of the soul in several different frameworks, but we have it as a total cause for man's emergence. We have the belief, esoterically advanced, that at a certain time, arbitrarily set in some systems as during the period which divided the Lemurian species from the Lemurian race, perhaps a very long time ago, not less than 40 million years ago, that a division actually took place, and that a part of the biological growth in nature became capable of sustaining a kind of psychic entity. The animal kingdom also reached a point where it could sustain a psychic entity. Every kingdom, including the mineral, has psychic entities. In the mineral, the proof of this is crystallization and the forms, the geometrical patterns which it takes. These different degrees of integration of body meant a constant moving of being into body on many levels. But that most vital to us as human beings is the motion of the human being into its relationship with body. As long as psychology neglects the identity of being and fails to recognize that the principal directive of man is being and not body, and that the principal source of man's growth is not environment or heredity, but being, but that environment and heredity become the boundaries or become sensors over growth, so that by these factors growth is advanced or retarded, then we find that the purpose of science is truly to become the handmaiden of being. That the purpose of science is to clear the confusion in body, mind, and emotion, in order that the clear stream of being may be more immediately available. The conflict of body and being results in premature age and the destruction of man long before his time. When the conflict and competition in the relationships of body and being, the competition arising primarily from body, when this is understood and overcome, a great variety of situations, both cultural and physical, at the present time burdening the life of man, will be removed. And the individual entering into a partnership between being and body will discover that in this way he makes possible the more rapid development of himself. His purpose always is that body shall become immediately responsive to being. Therefore, actually, that all purposes by which man lives and cultivates and develops shall become sensitive to and responsive to the total purpose of being itself, and that man will never be happy until he fulfills being, and that the general and natural and inevitable purpose of being is to unfold into expression the innate creativity of itself, a creativity beyond our comprehension. Therefore, man comes of age biologically, sociologically, culturally, philosophically, and spiritually when he becomes creative. Creativity rests in being and is communicated to body. And man becomes creative when he moves from within himself, and he usually becomes destructive when his life is governed only by body motion. To understand this is to advance one step in our study. I see the clock has advanced also, so we will continue this next week.